Or 356, 356.
I remember not too long ago that a young college-age Christian lady approached me and said, I need to talk to you for just a little bit. And she confided in me. She said, Ken, I'm scared because I'm not sure if I believe in God anymore. And her dad was a leader in the church. She had grown up in the church. We get really, really concerned and involved and asking questions when our children or someone that we love finds himself in such a situation. And to be forewarned is to be forearmed. We're talking about doubt and reasons for doubt. And there's not every doubt comes from the same source or at the same point in our development of our faith. And when it's someone that we love and when it's someone that we really want to help, then we want to know everything that we possibly can that will enable us to help them. And one of the things that is very helpful if we can determine why a person has doubt. And there are any number of reasons why we have doubt. Some people think that just requiring reasons to believe in God is an insult to God. Listen to what Jesus had to say in John chapter 10. Jesus answered them, is it not written in your law, I have said, you are gods? And now he's going to do some reasoning with that. And he just quoted from Psalm 82. He said, if he called them gods, to whom the word of God came, and the scripture cannot be broken, what about the one whom the Father set apart as his very own and sent into the world? Why then do you accuse me of blasphemy because I said I am God's son? Do not believe me unless I do what my Father does. But if I do it, even though you do not believe me, believe the evidence of the miracles, that you may learn and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father. And again, they tried to seize him, but he escaped their grasp. On more than one occasion, the Jews picked up stones to stone Jesus, and this was one such occasion in verse 31 that would be the setting for this verse, these verses that I just read, that they have now become convinced that he's a blasphemer because he claims to be the Son of God, and he gives this as one of the proofs. And he said, don't just believe me because of my words. He said, look and see what I do. And if I do the same work that my Father does, then believe me for the sake of the miracles, not just what I said, but what I do. And so Jesus didn't chastise them for wanting some evidence to prove that he was who he claimed to be. But you see, I'm not talking about those when I talk about doubt and trying to help people who have doubt. I'm not talking about those who do not want to believe. And there are those in our society, some because of immorality, some because we love the world too much and what it has to offer. I'm addressing those who are honestly seeking to know the truth and who want to believe. You see, arrival at faith must follow the sequence, first of all, that we must understand our needs, our true needs. And secondly, having at least to some degree understood what our true needs are, we realize that if in fact it is true, Christianity has the answer to our needs. And then thirdly, We must know on the basis of adequate evidence that Christianity is true. And those three things are steps in our faith. We must understand our need. We must know that if it's true that Christianity has the answer to our needs. And number three, we must know that Christianity is true. And those things all build on one another. And doubt comes at each level. Or let me say, at least it can come at each level. And in case I haven't tied it together for you, we've already talked about those three levels and how that doubt comes at each one of those levels. The first one is doubt from ingratitude, that we really don't understand what our need is and what God has done for us. And secondly, at the second level, that we must realize that if it's true that Christianity has an answer to our true problems in life. And the second area in which doubt comes is from an improper view of God. If you think that God has promised something that he hasn't, or if your expectations of what God is going to do for you is different than what God has promised, then when it doesn't happen like you think it should and you pray and God doesn't jump at your command and doesn't respond like you think he ought to, then doubts come into your heart and into your life. And then thirdly, as we're seeking to find out if in fact Christianity is true and Christ really is the Son of God and God really does exist, then there comes doubts based on weak foundations or lack of evidence that we really just don't know if it's all true or not. And so we need to know as we are talking with our friends and with our children, with our grandchildren. If they have doubts, we don't need to become alarmed. We all have doubts. We all have dealt with doubts in our life. And doubt doesn't mean unbelief. Doubt means that I'm trying to find out, or at least it should serve that purpose in our lives. And as we look at the different levels from which doubt can come, if you can understand what level that person is at, then you can target in on what they need to help settle their doubts. And now that we've come to this point, my question is, when we arrive at this point, have we arrived at the level of faith that we've been trying to reach all of our lives? And the answer is, interestingly, no. We're not quite there yet. We have a foundation. The facts are in. The evidence has been presented. Conclusion is obvious. Christianity is real. Jesus was, in fact, a historical figure. He truly is God's Son. But to this point, you've been a searcher. And a searcher becomes a believer when he chooses and commits himself to the consequences of his choice. In other words, you've got to jump in the water. You can talk about the water, and you can take the temperature of it, and you can analyze it, and you can survey it, and you can measure it, and you can do all of those things. But it is of no benefit until you actually commit and get into the water. And so it is with Christianity. You can talk about Jesus Christ and God and evidences for the rest of your life. In fact, you can just stack as many lifetimes on top of one another as you want, and you can talk about those things on and on and on and become ever learning and never able to acknowledge the truth, can't you? And so you can live in that world if you choose to. But there comes a point in our life, if we're going to have the faith, then we must commit ourselves to the cause. We must make a decision. We must make a choice. Because if we stay at that level of just observers, of sitting on the sideline, of being inquirers, then doubts come at that level also. The necessity of commitment. There comes a critical, crucial time in the life of every believer when we must make a commitment or we'll be unable to remain even a believer. You with me? Doubts will come and you won't even truly remain a believer at that point. When you have progressed to the point that it's time to make that commitment, if you don't make that commitment, and if you keep being a seeker and an observer and just a gatherer of facts, then you won't even remain a true believer. Doubts will come in, and your belief, that belief that you do have, will have holes in it, and they'll get bigger and bigger. Romans chapter 10, verse 7 through 10. I'd like for you to turn there with me. It's a really interesting passage of Scripture. It's a deep passage of Scripture. Those who are studying, that we're studying together the book of Romans right now, you'll have a particular appreciation for this passage. But in Romans chapter 9 through 11, now that the gospel, the tenets of the gospel have been presented, that justification is by grace through faith apart from works of law, then there's a question that has to really be dealt with in the minds, particularly of the Gentiles, who are the primary recipients of this epistle. Because one of the things that's going to come into their mind is, well, if this is really true, if this is really real, then why is it that the Jews, by and large, haven't believed? And that's a real obstacle at this point in history. Why is it that the people to whom God has delivered a big portion of His Word, why is it that they have rejected Jesus Christ? Why have they not en masse become Christians? And so chapters 9, 10, 11 is going to deal with that. And in chapter 9, he's going to approach it from God's perspective, and I'm not going to go there in this lesson. But in chapter 10, he's going to approach it from the individual Jew's perspective. And he says, and let's set the context here in chapter 10, Paul says, "My heart's desire and prayer to God for the Israelites is they may be saved. I can testify they're zealous for God, but their zeal is not based on knowledge." Now look at verse 3. "Since they disregarded the righteousness that comes from God and sought to establish their own righteousness, they did not submit to God's righteousness." Why is it that some people are going to miss out on God's gift of righteousness? Verse 4, "Christ is the end of the law so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes." And now in verse 5, he's going to go back and he's going to quote Moses. He says, Moses, and now he's making a contrast between law righteousness and imputed righteousness. Moses describes in this way the righteousness that is by the law. Here's what he says, and this is a quote from Leviticus 18. "The man who does these things will live by them." Moses described law righteousness in that way. He said, if a man keeps that law, by that law he will live. That's another way of restating what he just said. So it is contingent upon a person keeping law righteous completely in order to be righteous. You can't make a single mistake. And so that's what Moses said about law righteousness. You'll live if you keep that law perfectly. But now, interestingly, "but the righteousness that is by faith," I'm in verse 6, says, "do not say in your heart who will ascend into heaven or who will descend into the deep." Now you notice that I left the parenthetical expressions out. I just gave you the quote from Moses, by the way. The righteousness that's by law, Moses described it in this way. But the righteousness that comes by faith, he says, "do not say in your heart who will ascend into heaven or who will descend into the deep." And Paul put some commentary in there for you. Now, we're not going to plumb the depths of this passage right here tonight, but I hope we'll at least skim across the top of it so we'll know what he's saying. Does it come as a shock to you to know that Moses talked about the righteousness that comes by faith? You see, we think that people under the old law were justified by the law, and today we're justified by faith. But if we think that, we're wrong. Because people have always been justified by faith. And even as far back as Moses, when Moses was bringing that Ten Commandment law down from Sinai, what were the people doing at the base of the mountain? Even as he was coming down, they were breaking every one of them. He knew that people weren't going to be able to keep that law and be justified by that law. Certainly by revelation from God, he speaks. But he speaks about a righteousness that doesn't come from law. He speaks about a righteousness that comes by faith. And Paul will say that he was pointing toward Christ. Moses didn't understand everything about what he was saying, I'm sure. But he said, who's going to bring somebody down from heaven? Who's going to go into the grave and resurrect somebody and bring somebody up? Well, guess what? Somebody is. God's going to do that, isn't he? In the person of Christ. And so, verse 8, he says, but what does it say? The word is near you. It is in your mouth. It is in your heart. What word? That is the word of faith that we are proclaiming. He's saying that Moses looked ahead and he saw a righteousness that was going to come by faith, and it was going to come how? Through a delivered message. And that message was going to be brought by Jesus Christ, wasn't it? And that message was going to produce faith. He says that if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised from the dead, you'll be saved. That's what it takes to be saved. For it's with your heart you believe and are justified, and with your mouth that you confess and are saved. And by the way, it's interesting that he uses those two words there. Justification would be the positive side of salvation. It's what you get, this righteousness. And being saved would represent the negative side. You're not going to get what you deserve. You're going to be saved from the punishment. So we don't, negative side, saved, means we're saved from punishment. The positive side, justified, means that we're receiving God's righteousness. By the way, I won't plug it in there, but if you'll write John 3:16 right beside it, it fits right in there because he uses the same two concepts in John chapter 3, verse 16 that we all know. But what is he saying in the overall context here? And sometime we'll come through this and pick it apart a little bit better than we have have tonight. But what he's saying is, there are two things that have to come together. He says, the word is near you in your mouth and in your heart, for it is in your heart that you believe and are justified. It's with your mouth that you confess and are saved. There are some people that only get to the mouth level of belief, that we'll say it and we have a belief in it. And we'll talk about that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. But it never does get in here. We never do get it in that heart. We never do make that commitment, that full commitment. And so Romans chapter 10, verse 7 through 10 demonstrates a relationship between faith and commitment. There comes a time when we must make a full decision to jump in with both feet and both hands. And the tragedy of uncommitment is illustrated in John chapter 12, and I'll begin reading in verse 2. Yet at the same time, many, even among the leaders, believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they would not confess their faith for fear they would be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the praise of men more than the praise from God. Isn't that a sad tragedy? That there were people among the Jews who believed that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, but they would never confess it. They would never make a commitment to it. They would never dedicate their life to following him. And until we've dedicated and committed our lives to following Christ with no reservations, having counted the cost, putting both hands firmly to the plow without looking back, then every pressure that comes into our life is going to raise uncertainties or doubts. And every price that we're called on to pay for discipleship is going to be too much. And we're going to keep taking a step back and a step back and a step back. And we're going to try to stay in the shadows. And we're going to continue to sit in the stands. And we begin to think, well, perhaps this isn't true after all. And every new voice that comes along carries as much weight as the last one. And we're just going back and forth and in and out. And everybody that comes up with some new argument or some new idea, we're just swept away with it. And we really get to a point where we say, well, you know, I just don't know if all this is true, which really translates to, I never really believed this all much anyway. The problem at that point is not Jesus. It's not Christianity. It's not its ability to meet my needs. What's been lacking is your commitment to it. And that's the real problem. The doctrine has never become quite real to us. The lack of commitment keeps it all in the realm of theory. But you see, when you're fully committed, no price is too great. And doubts don't come in so easily. Let me try to illustrate that to you. My wife and I have been married for a bunch of years now. And through the years, I've grown to know her character, her nature, her dreams, her desires. And because of that, my faith in her is firm. And it's not easily shaken. And it's not really subject to your opinions about her. Your opinion of her doesn't change my opinion of her. And my confidence in her does not depend or is not shaken by your doubts, are your suspicions, are your accusations. You see, I would die for her. And she knows that. And so the cost of providing for her, keeping her secure, keeping her safe, is an honor on my part. And it's not subject to what other people think about it. I mean, it's fine if you think that she's a good person, because I would certainly agree with you. But if you don't, that really doesn't shake my faith in her at all. And if there's something about her that gives you heartburn, then I'm sorry about that, but that same thing doesn't have to happen to me because of it. You understand what I'm saying? Commitment automatically sorts out your priorities. And if you're fully committed to the Lord, then because somebody comes along and criticizes your belief, doesn't make that much of a difference to you. Because somebody else may raise some doubt because this thing comes along and that comes along in our society, and it just looks like society shifts from here to there to yonder, and here comes Oprah with her stuff, and here comes, you know, this person with this doctrine or writing this new book, and this new movie comes out and everybody's talking about it. And does that shake our faith when the Da Vinci Code comes out? I mean, does that shake your faith? Well, that depends on your level. It depends on how deep your faith goes and how firmly rooted you are. If you're not committed to something, then everything becomes equally serious about it. Or I might say equally unserious about it. And that's why there's so much uncertainty and unrest in people's mind. And it's why we get carried away with so many new ideas. It's why so many of us get depressed about something. Or maybe so easily discouraged. Or maybe so easily sidetracked onto this or that. Or so easily manipulated by public opinions. Or so, maybe it's why we're so enamored or committed to things in this world. You see, one of the reasons that we don't have, some of us don't have any really big problems, is because we've made our little problems so big. Because they're the only ones we have. And so we make mountains out of molehills, or we allow molehills to become mountains, don't we? But if you're really committed to something and you're on a path, and you have a plan, and you're moving somewhere in your life, then other people coming in on the side, and other people even trying to cast doubts against it, it's not really going to affect you that much. You'll address those, but you're not going to let that stop you. You're not going to sit down and let that cause you to quit moving in the direction of following Jesus Christ. We just sang a song. I mentioned to Sonny, and And that's one of the good things about having a song leader like the song leaders that we have. I mention a song to them and they sing it immediately without having to practice it. But oh, for a faith that will not shrink, though pressed by every foe, that will not tremble on the brink of any earthly woe, that will not murmur or complain beneath the chastening rod, but in the hour of grief or pain will lean upon its God. A faith that shines more bright and clear when tempests rage without, that when in danger knows no fear, and darkness feels no doubt. Lord, give us such a faith as this, and then whate'er may come, we'll taste even here the hallowed bliss of an eternal home. C.S. Lewis warned, "Your bid will not be serious if nothing much is staked on it. And you'll never discover how serious it was until the stakes are raised horribly high. Until you find out that you're playing not for counters or sixpences, but for every penny you have in the world. Nothing less will shake a man, or at any rate a man like me, out of his mere verbal thinking and his merely notional beliefs. He has to be knocked silly before he comes to his senses. Only torture will bring out the truth." Such is faith. The most crucial moment in your life is when you realize that Christianity will not work without total commitment. Until you get all the way in. You can't just wade around it up to your ankles or up to your knees and expect it to work for you. It's not going to. And when the world sees those who claim to be disciples of Jesus Christ truly following Him, truly committed to Him, then you know what? The world's not going to have nearly so many doubts. But when they see us playing with it, when they see us half committed, then they play the same game that we do. And they can throw up any excuse that they want. You see, God has done everything that He can. Jesus has done everything that He can. And you? Well, what about you? You've been considering it, you say? Maybe you've been involved. Maybe you've been making some contributions in some way. Maybe you've been sitting on the front row of the stands. Maybe you've been cheering on those who are running the race and hoping that they win. But at this moment, it really does not matter at all what the person who's sitting next to you decides or what they think. You're about to decide. And remember, not to decide is to decide. And maybe you're experiencing some doubts because when we just stay in the stands, when we just stay the seeker, then what we become in reality is a critic. And we're not growing, and doubts come, and those doubts stay, and they grow, and they rob us of what faith we have. And until we make a full commitment to the Lord that I'm going to truly be your disciple and I'm going to follow you with my whole heart, with all of my pocketbook, with all of my time, with all of my energy, with all of my family, with everything that I have. You see, there are enough spectators and there are enough critics. And believe it or not, there are enough contributors. What the Lord wants and what He's seeking is disciples. To be His follower. To be totally committed to Him. Because anything less than that and it won't work for you. You're only fooling yourself. And maybe a few people around you. But it's not really working for you. If you're not totally committed to the Lord. You see, because a disciple, And we can define it in a lot of ways, but the Bible gives a pretty good working definition of what a disciple is. It's somebody who's dropped his nets and he's following Jesus. And that's what he's seeking while we stand and sing.
I need to make you aware of something, and